My name is Dick Peterson, and the title of this particular discussion tonight is Opting for a Global Gospel, Expanding Christian Sensitivity. Now, tonight I really won't be speaking that much about Liberia, unless it comes in later in the discussion, but this is more of a kind of a beginning topic. And then during the next sessions of the week, we'll do more specific looking at those issues that might be classified as global issues that where the gospel comes to bear on them. But we'll probably hit a few of those tonight too, but I'm hoping that later on we'll also have a number of you contributing where you've come in terms of your own global gospel interpretation. I thought I'd start with one of the more simple definitions of the gospel. Martin Luther used to call John 3:16 the miniature gospel because it's really very specific, short, to the point, some 25 or 26 words, simply to say that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whoever believes in him should not perish but have everlasting life. It's a kind of a starting point for what we've described as the Christian gospel that's proclaimed throughout the scriptures. I kind of wanted to lift up the one word that, for tonight, the word world that's in there, for God so loved the world. We usually think of it in this particular verse, context of this verse, that it has to do with a world of people. That all peoples throughout the world, by coming to know the God whose grace is revealed in Jesus Christ and relate to that God through faith, can have this promise, this good news of the gospel, which is forgiveness, everlasting life. This has been probably the central gospel focus of the church for most of its history. This idea of bringing the message of Jesus Christ to people, even in various countries of the world, inviting them to experience this good news, this grace of God, this gospel, and to respond with in our Lutheran context, with baptism and faith. We've really focused a lot on the whole topic of sin and forgiveness, how to be a person who, in the presence of God, can experience a gracious God, a forgiving God, that our sins don't burden us down, that life can have a meaning and a direction, that life can have a goal of eternal life to look forward to. It's been when you think about the average program of the average congregation, it's really very much oriented toward helping people come to a faith in Jesus Christ, a personal experience of faith. The person, so we focus on gospel proclamations from the pulpit. If you think about confirmation instruction in the church, it's usually focused around the teachings of the small catechism to try to give people first an idea of when you talk about the Apostles' Creed, who is this great God who's created us, this God who has provided us with all we need from day to day. Talk about this God who comes to us when we're lost and lost in sin, or simply lost to God in some form, and through Jesus Christ comes into our world, ministers to share with us what God is like, to be God in our midst, to suffer with us and suffer for us. All of this to encourage us to open our hearts to a faith relationship with God. The Holy Spirit, who then is described as being the divine force behind opening us, helping us to believe that the truths of the gospel, helping us to find the strength to live in directions that are in keeping with the gospel. Baptism, Lord's Supper are ways to channel the grace into our lives so that we can have this strong, confident, personal faith in Christ. When we study the Bible, most people who get into Bible study with any intensity are doing it because they're trying to, at least it's been the history of the church, that people have gotten into the Bible to try to firm up their faith relationship to God, clarify just how it is that they can be confident of having salvation. Jesus is seen as, again, the one who brings his teachings and his way of dealing with people. We can clarify our confidence about the person of God. Apostle Paul, when he talks about how faith in relationship to Christ brings this salvation to people. Book of Concord, not too many, even Lutherans are very aware of that, what that's about. But it too is one of those historical documents that tried to put together Lutheran understandings of what the basic teachings of the scriptures are, and in a particular time in history when the national religions of the different countries in Europe needed to clarify where they were relative to the Holy Roman Empire. And those really also focus on the whole topic of justification by faith. How does a person find a justified relationship to God, and how do you separate that from what you call good works, and how does your awareness of the sacraments fit in with understanding that God justifies you by faith alone through grace, and all those writings. It's a book, it's as thick as the Bible, and it talks about all the different teachings of the church that have to do with either contributing to or detracting from your personal experience of God's undeserved grace and salvation. So this has been the direction of the theology of the church, and it's not one that we're going to leave behind by any means. It's probably still very descriptive of what the church is all about, bringing individuals to a personal relationship to God through faith in Jesus Christ, and then trying to develop a confidence and a lifestyle that supports and undergirds that, so that as the confessions, you know, say the devil, the world, and our own flesh can't take this away from us. And so we look to the scriptures to give us ideas of how we should live in terms of a personal self-discipline, if you will, so that keeps this faith from being lost. Luther says you're supposed to do good works to exercise the spirit in you and to keep the devil from taking over your life, and it gives other sets of reasons why you do good works, but it's not to earn your salvation, but it's just to help keep your salvation. It's like exercise for your body. It keeps your spiritual muscles in shape. Okay, then for once in a while, though, in a given culture, you get a certain kind of things that you're supposed to do or not supposed to do relative to the culture. And in our history, some of these have been like not smoking or not going to movies or not playing cards or things that are to be considered outward forms of a good, solid faith. And I can still remember when I was a pastor up in Wainwright, Alberta, my first parish. I think the first Sunday I was there, I found out about how the last pastor had been forced to resign because he gave a sermon once on the wedding at Cana in Galilee, and he dared to suggest that it was all right for Christians to drink. And he had it was a fairly dry area of the country there in rural Alberta, and they happened to have one of the people from the legislature that was a very prominent member of the church who was a strong teetotaler. The bishop made the mistake of coming up there and defending the pastor, and he too got on the blacklist. And while we were there, I know we were trying to win over the friendship of a nearby Haugi Synod Lutheran Church to help maybe merge with one of our parish points. And people said, well, you know, they're very pious people, so we kind of had to sort of have to live a certain way. And so we didn't go to any movies and things while we were up there, except toward the end of the time we were there, we wanted to go to a movie, and it was The Sound of Music. nothing too risque or anything. So we kind of looked around and went in there one day and sat down in the theater in Wainwright. And during the movie, we kind of just looked around, and sitting just about three or four seats away from us were two of the strongest members of this Haugi Synod Church. So after that, kind of cleared the... But those are some of the things that have been part of the Christian ethic and in various forms through, at least in the Lutheran tradition, through its history. And what we usually try to do is to keep the self-disciplines for this life of faith as simple and clear as possible, generally as well accepted as possible, and not too complicated, because it's easier to pass on to your children something that's not too difficult, not too controversial. It's easy to keep it going in the community and find a broader acceptance. Now, I'm hoping that while I was saying all this, you're kind of thinking about what you went through in your own terms of your own growth experience in faith coming up, if you did come up through the church structures. And I guess what I want to do is just kind of have your help now when we try to think of how do we take this faith that we've grown up with, it's fairly individualized, or at best focuses out to the family and the congregational boundaries, maybe your relatives that live in the same community, but how does it get out past that without adding something that's either too difficult or something that you think is going to become a good work that confuses you on your feeling that the grace of God is a free gift. I think that most of us here can probably have some confidence in saying we've gotten to a place in our Christian life where it's finally soaked in that it is the grace of God that saves us, and that it's not something that we're going to be doing. And whatever we feel are the self-disciplines of our life that keep the faith strong for us, they're not something that we'd ever want to trade in. It's not like they're that difficult to do. There's something that we enjoy doing by this time. It's like the person that found the pearl, great price, and he went and sold everything he had to purchase it. Well, nobody had to convince the guy to do that. It was just something he wanted to do, or to go find the field with the treasure hidden in it. He probably didn't spend all that time figuring out whether he wanted to invest in the field. It was just what wanted to do, because he knew that the great value that was to be procured from it. I think most of us get to the place in our Christian faith where we're not worried about the disciplines that we need to involve ourselves in. It's just something we want to do to keep the faith strong. But what I wanted to do tonight is just find out from you now, when you think about your own life and if and how you become involved in applying your Christian faith to something that would, I suppose, be described as a social issue or a global issue, something that in some respects doesn't really seem to have a spiritual necessity or quality to it, like ancient forests, keeping things from, you know, things that are related to protecting the environment, or even maybe in war or peace issues. Something that would not necessarily be directly connected to your own feeling about your faith life in relationship to Christ, but somehow you've gotten into it and feel like it's an important part of your Christian life. Again, something that you really hardly feel like you can do without anymore. And I'll give just one example of, for me, how something became a part of my Christian involvement. And then just kind of an example, and then I'm hoping that some of you would be willing to share some of the ways that you did it too. When we went to seminary, my wife and I was going to seminary, and she was putting me through. We got a job at this children's home in Moline, Illinois, Bethany Home, and it was for emotionally disturbed children, boys and girls. We were hired to be house parents, professional house parents for these 10 boys, ages 6 through 17 or 18. And we just got married 6 months before that, and so we couldn't exactly consider ourselves experts in the field of child development or anything. I majored in physics and math at university, and my wife was in speech and drama. And so. But anyway, we got this job, and for 6 days one week and 5 days the other week, 24 hours a day, we were in charge of these 10 boys. And we had the help of a cook and somebody did the laundry, and they had a recreation director in the afternoon, and sometimes they went to school. I mean, they went to the public school. We did that for 3 years. And learning with the work with the social workers, the children would come home from having a visit with their parents, and they'd be a nervous wreck for a couple of 3 days, and we'd kind of learn what kind of devastating effect these kind of family settings can have on these children. Well, for 3 years we did that, and then graduated from seminary. Another miracle came along. went to Brainerd, Minnesota for internship, and we didn't do too much with children there, except that we started some proceedings to adopt our oldest daughter. And then when we got up into, our first call was up into Wainwright Czar, and he ended up in Alberta. And the adoption hadn't quite been completed in Brainerd, so they transferred it up to the Department of Welfare in the province of Alberta. So in working with the provincial social worker, we got to finding out about that there were problems and need for children to have foster care, particularly children that were of Indian and Eskimo crossbreed, called half-breed or Métis Indian. So over the period of 3 years we were in Wainwright, we had a whole lot of these usually smaller children living in our family. We took care of them for a year or two, and so we learned all about this. We became involved in that particular aspect of child development. And then we started procedures to adopt our second daughter while we were in Wainwright, and we moved to British Columbia, and we hadn't finished the procedure there either, so we got involved with the British Columbia Welfare Department. And while we were doing that, we found out that they had a problem in New Westminster, that there was no what we would call a remand home, which was a place where runaways and youth that were in trouble with the law could be housed, other than in the public jail with hardened criminals during the time they're waiting for their court hearing. So we said, well, we've had some experience in that. So we started taking these runaway youth into our house, and they weren't the hardened criminal type, but some of them just were runaways, and some we found out later what they were up to. But one stole my car, and one stole a bunch of stuff and tried to run out, and several of them had drug trips while they were in our house. But we did that for a while, and then that led into, there's no group home in the city, so we had experience with the Bethany home, and we set up some administrative guidelines and had led the church to buy a house, and we set up a group home for teenage girls and ran that for 3 years while we were there. Okay, that was about the period of time that we were involved in care and concern about children, youth, and that was the heaviest time in that. Our four children by that time were getting to the place where we thought, well, maybe it's not too good idea to have all these people staying in our house all the time. And then we moved to Seattle and kind of got away from it for a while. But that's the example of how we got involved with social kind of ministry, that not really for any particular reason of training or skill, but just kind of happened into it. and just kind of continue to develop it. Now, that's with my example. Now, I just was wondering if some of the rest of you would be willing to, something that you've either have been or are still involved in that you would think of it as a kind of a outreach of your Christian faith into an area of either global concern or social issue. Somebody be willing to share something like that?
That's a tough act to follow.
I was trying to give I'll come up with a term for it later on, but it's a...
I don't do this on any regular basis, but through our church, our church has set up like a Friday lunch to feed the... I live in Dallas, in Seattle, and set up the Friday, every Friday there's a lunch for like 3 hours and you can volunteer, and I haven't done it very many times, but that is a need that I felt, you know, tug in my heart as something I'm really capable of doing. But just making sandwiches or handing out sandwiches or just...
How did you get into it? I mean, did they advertise for help or something?
Well, in the bulletin they said, you know, Friday lunches, but it's something that's been probably on my mind for about 4 years, and it was just, it happened that the church I go to naturally had the facilities, so you could just step in and do it. And it's really, really interesting just to talk to people and say God bless you and hello, and just see people as they are. Basically, it's a good straight population of Valor.
Yeah.
I can't take any credit for much, but our church, in coordination with several other churches in the Seattle area, have set up, or are in the process of setting up, a house for transitional housing for recovering alcoholic street people, more or less. And we're in the process of getting this all together so that it can house, I think it's 8 to 10 people, while they're going through treatment and getting readjusted to join the quote-unquote regular world.
Okay. Do you know how the church got into that, or how
individuals? It was a group of people in our church that got together and said, there's a real need here, and joined with groups in some of others of our neighborhood churches to organize this program and set that up. It was kind of a grassroots thing. It wasn't necessarily directed by the synod office or anything.
Sure. Just wondering if you could think of any one that was the kind of the spearhead for the project, and maybe don't know them that well, who they would be, what would be there.
Well, one would be, you want names?
No, I'm just saying, well, if you could think of an individual, maybe what was a particular thing that motivated that person to get it going in the first place?
You know, I have no idea. I mean, there's an obvious need for it, a clear need for it, and, I mean, it just something that he felt strong about, so hey, we can do something.
Maybe I'll...
We're from a small congregation, but for about 15 years, we've had people from a mentally retarded home nearby attend our services. And it's involved most of the people in our church one way or another. We've had classes for them during the week for cooking and various other things, but every Sunday we have from 10 to 15 of these people attending, and certain people have befriended one or the other. Some of them had them in their homes and things. And I think this whole program was started by our pastor's interest in having a cooperative project with this home.
Well, we had one night a week a special ed where they came to church, and it was a whole evening of, I think it's games or an activity and lunch. It wasn't cooking anything. But now that's been abandoned. There were people interested, the minister was interested, and he even went to some, continuing education to enhance his interest, but somehow or other it became fewer and fewer people that were being involved in it. So now all they do is they come to church, not too many people are involved in it either. wonderful program. And
when we were in West Africa, of course this is some time past now,
it's all right.
But we were in, we had, I can't tell you how many school children that, like you, they stayed in our house. They did work for us, for, you know, a little bit of work. And we would then see that they went, they had their school fees, their school uniforms. They would come to our house, and we, mostly Harold, would help them with their homework. And that was in the Peace Corps, but then at the mission, when we, there would always be other children that would come. And we knew that if we weren't helping them, they wouldn't be able to go to school. And we never just wanted to give it freely, because they have a saying there, you probably know, they say, Liberia man don't like free thing, free thing. They don't want something that's free, they don't value it. And so we always made sure that they would do some small work for us. Mm-hmm. And then after we left, we continued. I mean, I can't tell you how many children there were, and now they're adults. But we've continued to do that, and they've become, were baptized also, and really came to know the Lord. Mm-hmm. And we've continued to assist them in their school, like to get one to get to Covington, and one went to Althea. These are our high schools and then at the college. They're still call us mother and father, mama and daddy, and but that was, the need was there, and we just knew it was a way we could do the Lord's work.
Mm-hmm. It was interesting at the last hospital we were at, the Bush Hospital. And I think it was practically built by, well, he's a Dr. Mertens from, and he...
from Minnesota?
Yeah, and he was, he went into so many facets. He had a smaller place there, well, just like you might say, like a bunkhouse. There was a kitchen outside where they could cook. But that was for the children of the people who, I guess it was mothers that died during birth or something. And then they'd get a relative to come there and stay with this child, but the hospital would feed it. And then they had the TB, and they had, what's the other disease? They had the...
measles?
No, they had...
you know, the crippled.
I can't think of it. You got a bunch of them over
there. Herbs, and they lose their,
they
lose their hands.
Well, leprosy?
Leprosy, oh, yeah, right. Okay. They had a leprosy program there too. He really went all out. And I know I used to, almost any time I walked away from my little house, we were right on the compound, right near the hospital. And any time that I walked out of that door, and those little orphans down there would see me, and they'd all come, just tearing up there, want to hold my hand and walk with me wherever I went. And that was, we just enjoyed taking care of all those little tots whenever we got a chance to.
It's a very rewarding kind of a experience in that setting.
In Spokane, it seems to me, I don't know if this is the subject you want to talk, but it seemed to me like the established church discovered that they had problems in our community. It's not problems around the world, but problems right where we live. And those people in need did not come to them. And they finally decided they would have to go out to where these people were. Mm-hmm. And we've had a lot of programs in our community. They go by various names. Drug problems, children, hunger problem, and they are administered through a variety of ways, but not through the established church in our town. I don't know, but they've been going on for a long time, and the ministers are clearly identified with them and the people there, mm-hmm. but they're not really church oriented. They're more people and problem oriented.
This someone asked me before lunch today, this one fellow I met on the ferry coming up, he says, you know, we have to leave before you get started, so why is, can you give us a little nutshell what you're going to talk about? I said, well, maybe I'd have to define it as a stumble on it involvement. Just you see it, this has a particular problem, and so they get involved in working with a group that's working with that particular problem that children have. But with us, we got this job at this children's home because we needed a job while we went to seminary, and it ended up just being something that we just kind of built on. I just sort of stumbled into it. And it's scriptural, though, because, you know, the Good Samaritan was just kind of walking along the road and stumbled on this guy that had been hurt, and he got that work done. And in some respects, I think would be, you know, if a person is, a lot of these particular issues that come up, that face either on a global basis or just in a community basis, maybe it's just because you end up joining a congregation, you move in the town and you join a congregation that has a certain program, so you get involved in it that way. It's not wrong. I mean, I don't think it's too bad to call it a stumble in theology, but I don't know just how else people get involved in issues. The other thing I was thinking about is whether there might be any one of you here that became interested in this faith and God issue. You know, the other way around, you were involved in some ministry to someone, and you found that maybe like that the church was involved in it too or something, so that you became interested in the Christian faith. You know, kind of reversed this whole direction. I don't know if would that be true of any of you? You know what I mean? Like you weren't a Christian, you were doing something like maybe working on protecting the northern owl or something, and in the process you were giving lectures and stuff, and you found out that, you know, a number of Christians were interested in that, and so you said, you know, what do you go to church? And, I mean, so it's something that you kind of reversed the whole process and came into faith because the church was involved in one of these issues. Would that be true for any of you here?
That was true of me to a certain extent because I went to Zimbabwe in the late 60s and went with my husband, who was a seminary student, but I hadn't been in the church for about 4 years. And I was one of those who fell away, so to speak. But, you know, I did marry this seminary student, and we ended up going to Zimbabwe, and I thought it was going to be a grand adventure. And then have to say that it was the Zimbabwean people in our community there who brought me back into the church. In the sense of understanding the Christian faith from another perspective. Because I had the kind of faith that you're describing, that's what I grew up with, the one you described earlier in your talk. And only was more fundamentalist than that. It was a Lutheran church, but it was very fundamentalist. We weren't supposed to dance or do anything. And I had a pastor every Sunday who asked us if we were saved or not. Every single Sunday he asked us whether we were saved. It was only later I realized he was asking us whether we were saved because he had a radio ministry. I think he was asking his radio audience, but there we were listening to this. And one day I thought, I don't think I am saved, because if he's asking it every Sunday, I was, you know, very young, I thought, you know, I must not be, so why not just go dancing and have a good time? So that's when I left the church. But the Zimbabwean people helped me understand the depths of faith and how important it is to meet the needs of people, you know, just what people have been describing here, and how integral that is to faith. And then I think once you've experienced that, if you don't have that involvement in your life, you feel a big gap. You feel a big gap. And so, but it is a stumble. I mean, I went there for a grand adventure, and it turned out to be a bigger adventure than I thought. Thanks to them.
Any other? Well, it's a, let me see, this is, what I wanted to do is just kind of get started on this issue with you tonight, because tomorrow I'll more focus on Liberia, and again, the part of it will be just the problem of Liberia today. Part of it will be how the church has seen its roles being involved in ministry in Liberia. And then the next day, I can't remember exactly what the sequence is, but to do a look at Marxism and compare that with the writings of the, particularly the Old Testament prophets, but also the teachings of Jesus, the early Marxist writings. And then on Thursday, I think we're going to talk a little bit about Bishop Tutu and how, particularly how he addresses his theology to the issues of the apartheid problem in his South African country. So what I'm trying to do is see how people have taken how they express their faith and the teachings of their faith and apply them to these different kind of global types of issues that are going on. And on Friday, to look a little bit at this at the ancient forest. There'll be a couple other sessions on similar topics this week. So, but to see how does a Christian become involved in that kind of an issue, which, you know, really could be described almost as, you know, not necessarily an issue that a Christian would ordinarily become involved in. So, those are the kind of directions I'd like to follow with you this week.
Can I ask you, how do you come about the decision to go to Liberia? You and your wife?
Well, we thought we wanted to be missionaries in 1978. About the time we decided, my wife wanted to do some studying for ministry, and we were trying to figure out how to make that possible. One of the options we had thought about was, at the time, also was to become involved in foreign missions. So we went to, we took a trip all around the United States to look at all the seminaries and talk to everybody about getting physicians and things. And we went into the Division for World Mission and Ecumenism that was under the LCA, and I asked if there was any openings for missionaries overseas. And I don't know really what that had to do with our initial search, but the person at the desk, you know, I said, "How old are you?" I said, "I think I was 40 or 41. And they said, "Well, I'm sorry, you're really too old." So then 10 years went by, and or not quite 10, but we got interested in it again, and so we heard that Norm Newding, the personnel director for the Division for Missions, was leading a study group to Eastern Europe. And so we signed up to go that because we were interested in going, but we also signed up so we could get to meet him. And we spent 3 weeks with him, and then that's how this possibility for Liberia came. And I'd always told Muriel that the last place I'd go any place as a missionary, except as some hot, sweaty jungle in Africa. So that's where we went.
You might, I just have to make a comment about your age. Harold and I, when we first went into Peace Corps, we were, I can't even remember how old it was, but we were in our 50s. And then stayed on with the mission. And after we were home for a while, I was talking to Jerry Currens in the DWME office. And in fact, I was visiting in New York and went to see him. And so I told him that Harold and I were still interested, but I said, we're probably way past the age. He said, well, your age has nothing to do with it. He said, if you have a skill we need, that's all that's necessary. So, you know, just total opposite philosophy.
I think the part of it was the idea of language, learning of language, that there's a certain skill of learning language. But when you're able to go to a place like Liberia where you're basically dealing in English and it's and if you can pick up some local lingo to kind of help your communication skills, it's all right.
But I'd like to say that so many people think that to be a missionary you have to be a pastor or but that's not necessarily true, because it helps. But if you have a skill that they need in some country, you're a Christian, you're really welcome.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We had no problem. Of course, yeah. We were hired right there in Liberia for the mission after Peace Corps because they needed an engineer at the hospital, and then I worked my job. Yeah.
There were several. Is it? I think a great percentage of the people in Liberia are not what they call ordained clergy.
No,
it's only, I think there were only a couple of us there while we were there, three. But and several people came out of Peace Corps. Betty Cranwell and several others.
She's still in Liberia.
Mm-hmm.
Little girl, I don't know what's happened to her.
Yeah.
But Peace Corps, to me, Peace Corps is another field that you can practice your faith.
Mm-hmm.
You really can. They've never been told me. I've never been told that you can't do it or anything like that when you join Peace Corps. But we found that we probably were in more contact with the people in Peace Corps than we were in the mission.
I mean, they live under country. Yeah, they live under much more oftentimes primitive conditions than
in the
sort
village.
Of, mm-hmm. You don't get into like the compound setting like that you so often do as a missionary. So.
One missionary lady said to us, and her husband was a doctor at BB Hospital, and we had so many people that would come to visit us because they were friends from our other life, and Liberian friends. And this lady said to us, "I envy you so much because you have so many Liberian friends." And she said, "We never get a chance to know them that way because they live, you know, on this enclosed."
It's not, you know, not totally that you can't make contacts, but
it's hard,
right? But if you're in an institution, you know, that you're basically, because of the hours and involvement, you don't get out. If you're like Mary and I were, where we had pastoral responsibilities to go out to villages and things, and teaching in seminary in different ways, you do get to meet a number of different people that way.
If you're working in the hospital all the time, you know, you just see people as patients or as co-workers.
But every once in a while, you know, you go down to Monrovia and you're walking down the street and they say, some guy had come up or some woman had come up and said, "Oh, Pastor Peterson, you remember me? And I was a patient in the hospital." Really? I mean, they came and went so fast, you know, but they'd remember you even if you didn't remember them so much. But.
It's really fun to have the experience where you are in a small country like that, and everybody knows you. You may not know them, but everybody knows you, you know. When Ruth and I would be going somewhere in the back of one of these pickup trucks that they had for transportation, we'd see these little children along the roads, you know. Immediately they'd start yelling, "Old man Jacobson Baden," or something like that, you know, where we were from, Baden. And they start yelling, "Baden, Baden," and they knew who I was. If they saw me, you know, because I didn't know the children. But I was going to say about going to church there was rather difficult because where we were, because it was just a little town or the little village of Baden that we went to, and we didn't like to go every Sunday because the pastor spoke English, and he talked in the native language for maybe like two or three paragraphs, and then he'd repeat it in English to us. And it really put a hardship on him, you know, and it made the service so much longer that it was, but it was difficult. But he was really nice that way. And we asked him when he went home after 2 years in Peace Corps, we said, is there something you'd like to have, that, you know, to bring back? I think he was Baptist, I'm not sure. And he said, yes, a pulpit Bible. Mm-hmm. So we told our church when we got home about it, and they bought one, and we brought it back to him.
Wherever he would go, he would carry his big pulpit Bible.
That great big pulpit Bible.
Yeah.
He was so proud of that.
Great. Okay, this is another, you know, one of those things, if somebody that's been in the mission field comes and joins a congregation, and then just sort of lets out something that would be a need in the mission field, that is a way that, like, the whole congregation can sort of stumble into a ministry. You know, they're looking sort of for something, and there's a faith that would motivate to some action or service that's been developed with or without that kind of a broader perspective to it, but it can be just all of a sudden focused that way. And
it means so much to a congregation if they have, it's like a more personal involvement mm-hmm. than just giving the money for the Division of World Missions or something like that. We had that happen with our church, and for two of these youngsters that I told you about, each had special needs. One was for tuition and so on, like $500 or anything like this. But the World Concerns Committee in the church would like to participate in that. And they have a real personal involvement then with these people, and it means a lot to them.
That's one of the, you know, just kind of to conclude that, this particular one, but that's one of the ways that congregations can be involved in these things too. If you have a World Concerns Committee or whatever term that group has, they can find out, you know, either even from various members of the congregation where they're involved and if there's meaningful ministries that the congregation could get involved in, or individuals within a congregation. Those are people that get involved in these broader expressions of the gospel. You know, they're always really glad that they did. God, I wonder what they ever did before they got into them. And I always want to encourage others to get involved in it. And it's just it's one of the surprising joys of the gospel that you can get away from just, you know, being so concerned about whether you're personally saved. It doesn't mean that you ever give that up or that ever becomes less important to you, but it becomes more of a resource for strength rather than something that you're, you know, always wringing your hands about. So the church will probably continue to have that. Hopefully it will continue to have it as number one, bringing people to know the God who reveals the person of love and strength in Jesus Christ. And then to be able to turn the focus of our eyes to different things, sometimes just by accidentally making something available to us, and sometimes by organized planning work of a congregation that says this is an important agenda, or maybe something that happens in the community. So I think we'll stop for tonight then, and then I don't know what time, I think it's tomorrow morning, 10:35 or something like that. It should be up on the bulletin. And we'll focus more on Liberia tomorrow. And if you have any particular questions, feel free to bring them with you tomorrow.
Very good. Thank you.